This week's show with Claire Edwards, the Nomadic Maker, is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. In addition to the new Nashville market releases, Sassy Jack's is your source for the full line of reproduction samplers from Barbara Hudson of Queenstown Sampler Designs, along with Sassy Jack's own collection of sassafras samplers. Visit the workshop section at sassyjackstitchery.com to sign up for the Summer House Stitchworks event, August 4 to 5, and the September Soiree online retreat, September 15 to 18. Also, be sure to sign up for the Cosmo Floss Club so you can build your collection of beautiful, solid, and variegated Cosmo floss. Make Sassy Jack Stitchery your local needlework store by visiting the website at sassyjackstitchery.com. And now, our conversation with Claire Edwards, the Nomadic Maker. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, the Nomadic Maker, Claire Edwards. Claire, welcome.
Hi.
Well, it's going to be fun to talk to you because the nomadic part, when we started researching you and I saw you were stitching in your camper, I was like, oh, look at her. And traveling across Europe in it. Betsy, yeah, I love it. I got to know, how do you pack all your stitching stuff in there, though? Because mine doesn't fit.
Well, we bought a motorhome that would fit it. So when, you see, back in 2021 now, we decided that we were going to sell the house and move into our motorhome. And the first motorhome that we had was fantastic, but it didn't have particularly much storage space. So when we got the opportunity to upgrade the motorhome, we went half a meter longer, but also about 40 centimeters higher. So underneath the living space that we have inside, we have a double floor. So we have a huge garage at the back, and in the side, underneath where we live, is a huge storage area. So a lot of the stuff goes in there. But my daughter also stores a lot of the stuff. So when I closed down my home studio and was deciding what I was going to take with me and what I was going to pack, you know, that was really difficult. The whole room, that's the only thing that I really, really struggled with, is what can I get rid of out of my studio, and what am I going to keep, and how am I going to keep it, where am I going to store it? And I think the rest of the house, it wasn't an issue. It was just stuff that we collected over the years. But my studio, all my stuff and all my sewing stuff, you know, that was really, really hard. So I bought 10 huge boxes, big plastic boxes, and they went across to my daughter's, and I swap in and out with whatever materials I need, really. So my beads come with me, my frames come with me, and little boxes that I can pick up and go. So if, for instance, I'm away traveling for a few months at a time, I'll decide on what sort of projects I'm going to be stitching, and I'll decide on, do I need my beads, or do I need my gold work materials, or do I need a bit of both? So yeah, it takes a little bit of planning, but I've also got lots of storage as well.
Okay, we're lucky. That's great. Yeah, because I have just this little teardrop. And so it's always like, okay, I really would like to bring this project. I think it'd be great to stitch while I'm on the road. Yeah. But I have too much stuff in this bag. It just won't fit. But, yeah. You know, you have to make those decisions. And then I saw, you know, you're traveling across Europe with your camper. And I thought, oh, if I could just get my little teardrop there, how much fun would that be? To be traveling through these beautiful areas. There's so much beauty there in Europe to see. And in my little teardrop. but I think it'd be way too pricey to ship that thing across the ocean. So I guess I'll just be doing it here.
Yeah, it can be quite expensive. I watch, I know a couple have done that. They shipped their camper across from the UK across to the States, and then they've just shipped it across to Japan now. So then they're working their way back into Europe again.
Oh my! Shipped their mobile home from Europe to the US, and then oh my, I just can't imagine what that would cost. It wouldn't it be cheaper just to buy a new one? I mean, seriously.
Probably. I think they said it was about £8,000 to ship it from the UK to the US.
Well, okay, that's expensive, but less expensive than a camper, I guess. So
yeah. What an adventure.
Right. And hope it gets there. What happens if it gets misplaced somehow? I guess they don't misplace those, but you know.
Yeah, that'd be hard to lose.
It would, especially since it's our home as well. So.
Right.
So now, Claire, you live in a small bus, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. Nine meters long.
Yeah. So what is it that makes this lifestyle work for you? I mean, is this a full-time thing? Like, you guys live in this permanently?
We do, yes. We don't have any bricks and mortar at all anymore. We bought our mobile home back in 2019. And that came after, you know, a long period. You know, to cut a long story short, my partner got severely injured at work and then was medically retired. And what we found is that it was a real struggle in the house. And if we were to go anywhere, that was really a struggle as well. But in the motorhome, it's our home away from home, and we can move around. And it was a safety net, which he felt really comfortable in. So that's, you know, that was one of the reasons why we did it, really, because it just gave us a much better quality of life.
So he does better if you're able to move around then.
Rather than being stuck in the house, it's, you know, there was a lot of, you know, bad memories there. It's it was difficult, and just the whole cost of living with losing, you know, his income and everything else, you know, it was really difficult to think about how are we going to keep the house and everything going, and actually, you know, our quality of life and the cost of living, it hasn't really affected us, to be fair, because we're completely set up to be totally off grid as well. So all those rising costs from electricity and everything that we're all struggling with, it's not something that we've felt, really, and we're able to live quite a comfortable life now off the pension.
That's nice that you guys have like solar panels, correct?
We have, yes.
Right, to use, yeah. That makes a huge difference when you're traveling, and to use that instead of be stuck to the grid, you know.
Definitely. You know, we've got a roof full of solars. We've got some really good batteries. We've got great big tanks as well, so we can literally be off grid for a good couple of weeks before we need to go and fill up with water, or, you know, empty out our waste and everything else. So yeah, it means that we're not as well, because he was diagnosed with PTSD and I became his carer, and it means that we're not stuck in the middle of a town or a city anymore. We can be completely away from everywhere, which, you know, a lot of his triggers are around people and around crowds of people. So if we're in the middle of nowhere where there's nobody, you know, that's helpful. You know, that's really helpful for him. So, you know, we're very mindful of what works and what, you know, what we've tried to make work for us, really, in the long term. It's helpful.
Right. I don't have PTSD, but living in the middle of nowhere with nobody around is, I got to say, mighty appealing. So I'm jealous.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's something about that quiet and of being out and away from people and kind of being in nature. It kind of sparks, it calms you, and yet does it spark your creativity?
Definitely. Absolutely. My mind can be buzzing sometimes. You know, I'm there with my camera and I'm taking pictures and, you know, and it's just soaking it up constantly. You know, it can be hard to decide, what am I going to do next? Because I'm, you know, overloaded with beautiful imagery, really. And yeah, it's a nice place to be fair, when you're a creative.
Right. Right. So how do you take notes then? Do you take notes mainly by taking photographs, or do you keep a sketchbook?
So far I mainly take photographs. I have done sketchbooks before. I've also just bought a couple of more sketchbooks to take away with me on our next trip. So I'll be doing a lot more of that, and maybe doing other things as well, such as cyanotype and, you know, and then probably stitching into that. So, yeah.
Oh, cyanotype.
I do a bit of both.
Yes. Okay. So, cyanotype. So have you done cyanotype before?
I have, yes. And currently I'm teaching at university with the degree in surface pattern and textile design. So a couple of times a year, for about a month at a time, I'll teach on specific modules. So I'll come and go, really. So, and they're just doing a module at the moment on material innovation, and we've just done a little bit about cyanotype, and I thought, oh, I forgot I knew that, and I did a quick recap and I thought, oh, I will take it with me and I will do some when I'm away.
Yeah, see, I love cyanotypes, and then with the type of stitchery mm-hmm. you do, I could just see mm-hmm. I can see you being very creative with that. That'll be exciting yes. to see how you move forward with those.
It will. I'm looking forward to that, because it's not something that I've done a little bit of it before, but it wasn't combined with stitch. So I'm looking forward to really experimenting with that and seeing what I can come up with and around what I, you know, my techniques and what I normally do. So yeah, it's I'm looking forward to that bit.
So let me get a picture of this life, because this is fascinating. So we live in a mobile yeah. home. You teach yeah. at university. Do you teach full time or in intervals? How does that work?
No, I teach a couple of times a year. So I'll probably do in the December over Christmas time, I'll do maybe 6 or 7 sessions on a short module. And then I'll come back again round about Easter time and then teach another 6 or 7 sessions on that. And then I just go away again. So it fits in quite well, really, with how our lifestyle runs, really. So.
Okay. So when you're not teaching, then you know, the last module ends the last day. You guys are in the mobile home and out of town then.
Pretty much, yes. Yep.
Well That's played. Great. Well played. So the university kind of gives you a home base then. Every now and then you come back to that, but otherwise you're on the road and basically stitching and doing needlework and wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. Pretty much.
This is okay. Yeah.
See, that's the lifestyle I want to be doing.
Yeah.
But I need a bigger camper. I think I'd need a bigger camper to be able to do that. So,
yeah. I mean, some people do it in little campers.
I personally
couldn't.
So in your mobile home, do you have some kind of a studio set up, or are you stuffing in cabinets and pull it out when you need it?
Yeah, it's there's stuff outside in cupboards underneath Inside, underneath my sofas, I've got a big pull-out drawer where I keep my current work that I'm working on at the moment with my box of needles and threads and that sort of thing. And then on the other sofa, on the other side, I've also got some boxes which I keep my metal frame and a few bits and bobs in there as well, my material and all my beads and gold work things. So if it's raining, which in England it quite often is, I don't have to go outside and get wet. I can actually just pull stuff out of the drawers and everything. So yeah, I take up most of the space in the motorhome. My other half has a couple of cupboards in the back for his clothes and that's about it. You know, he goes, he pulls the drawer and goes, oh, that's your cupboard again, isn't it?
As it should be, as it should be. I mean,
absolutely.
As creatives, we need our space, right?
Right.
Definitely, definitely. To be fair, I've given him most of the wardrobe space.
Yeah. Close, secondary.
Oh man, what a deal. Yeah. What a deal. So how did this all get started? Did you learn needlework when you were young or is that a later in life thing?
No, this is a later in life thing. I didn't actually learn how to sew until I was in my mid 40s, and that's probably about 7 years ago now. And so it came about. I was working for a children's charity, managing a countywide service in North Wales, and I started to get quite ill, and to the point where some days that I couldn't even walk up the stairs. I was literally crawling up on my hands and knees, and the medical profession just couldn't work out what was actually wrong with me. So, you know, up until then I'd done nothing creative at all. I was just doing a normal 9-to-5 job, commuting backwards and forwards, and I went off on long-term sick leave, having lots and lots of trips backwards and forwards to the doctors, and it got to the point where I'd been off work maybe about 9 months, and I thought, you know, I can't do this, you know, I can't keep doing this. And I'd gone back to work 3 times, and as soon as I went back, I started to get worse again. But whilst I was at home on sick leave, I started to think, what else can I do with my time? I got fed up of watching Grey's Anatomy and all those box sets on telly. And, you know, I was driving everybody bonkers because I'm not used to sitting down and doing nothing. You know, it's not something that I've ever been able to do. And I thought, right, you know, there's a bit of a crochet craze going on at the moment. I will teach myself how to crochet. And I spent endless hours on YouTube, practicing, to the point where I got quite good at that. And I started to do a bit of journaling as well and a little bit of drawing. So when I came to figure out what I was going to do, I was about to resign from my job, and thinking about my future, still not knowing what was wrong with me, I decided to look at universities and see if there was anything there that piqued my interest. And one of the courses stood out really was 3D contemporary jewellery. So I applied, and off I toddled for my interview date with, they asked for a portfolio, and I thought, do you know what? I'm going to have to Google that because I have no idea what they're asking me to take, because I don't know what a portfolio was. You know, I didn't even have anything that I went to school with, because I didn't take any, you know, of those kinds of subjects. You know, they pretty much told me that I had no artistic talents whatsoever. And I learned more woodwork and electronics and technical drawing throughout school. So I didn't even have a background there. So off I went with my little journal and some crochet that I'd been doing, and went for my interview, and they took me on a tour around all the studios in the creative side of the university. And I saw this beautiful photo on the wall of a denim jacket that had been heavily embroidered and embellished. And I said to the lady that was interviewing me, that's what I want to do. So they took me to the textile design studio, and that was it. A week later, I started.
Wow.
You know, it's nothing like, you know, doing things at the last minute. You know, I applied the day before the closing date, so when all the rest of the students had already started.
Oh, my.
So, yeah, there I was. I tipped up to university and had absolutely no idea what I was doing there. I was, mid-40s, and the majority of the students there were all 18, and thought, do you know what? I've got a real opportunity here to just soak up everything that they're going to teach me. I was at a different place in life than all the rest of them who'd done all the creative subjects all the way from school. You know, I'm going to get to know them and ask them questions and, you know, and take as much as I possibly can from the experience, really, the opportunity that I'd been given. So that's how I ended up. That's where my creativity started, really.
And no art background, no stitching background.
Nope.
And here, nope, 7 years later, you're producing what you're producing. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
I quit. I quit. I'm done. I'm out. That's it.
I think I'd done maybe a couple of cross stitches when I was in the Air Force to pass a bit of time. And I don't think I actually finished a single one.
Wow.
That's amazing. That is fantastic. Because your work is so dimensional, you know, to go from not having any background and to making beautiful dimensional pieces. That's great.
Yeah, isn't that it, Beth? Is it's not just on a ground cloth, you know? So you could see designing on a ground cloth to, you know, just a plain surface, but no, it's a full 3D operation,
right
here. Wow,
right?
Wow, bravo, bravo.
Thank you. I think as well, because, you know, it's whilst I was doing my degree, there was a lot of drawing. It's mostly surface pattern, you know, but I wasn't really a fit for that as well. So I often looked at, you know, what I could do that fitted in with the modules, but how could I push the things that I was learning further? And although we had, in the second year, we got to do a module on stitch, that was the first time really that I'd done any type of stitches. And like I say, you know, it's not a university that teaches technical stitch at all either, because it's more about drawing and painting and creating pattern for surfaces like wallpaper and gift wrap and those sorts of things. So I struggled quite a bit as well with where did I fit, because I didn't consider myself to be a very good drawer. I'm sure, you know, my old tutors would say on the contrary that I can draw, I just don't enjoy it either. It's not something that I use all the time. I'll make sketches for my work and how I'm going to build a piece, but I'd rather make a model first out of plasticine or something else that will show me, you know, and allow me to build those 3D structures. So pretty much all of my embroidery techniques I'm self-taught as well through books and following YouTube techniques and actually just playing with materials, just experimenting with, you know, how, if I've got a load of beads and sequins and everything else, how can I put them together in a structure that's nobody else has done? And right. just, you know, it's about being playful with and combining different materials that you wouldn't normally put together.
Mm-hmm. So do you think because you were an older student when you entered the university, it gave you a little less fear to experiment? You weren't trying to see maybe so much what your neighbors were doing, you know, to compare with them?
I think so. I was there for me, first and foremost, and, you know, and about what I could take from that opportunity. I think your mindset is entirely different when you go in as a mature student from, you know, somebody who's 18 and come straight from school, and pretty much that is often expected. You go through school, you go through college, and then you go on to university, then you go out into, you know, into what the real world. And actually, I'm coming from it from entirely the opposite. I'd had those life experiences and I didn't have to prove anything to anybody. You know, it was about my journey. So it didn't matter that I didn't fit because right. I could just do what, pretty much do what I wanted to do in that thing, as long as I, you know, passed the degree and I had to hit all of the learning outcomes and that sort of thing. But I looked at it and did that my way, really. It's I suppose being experimental as well with everything. It's, I suppose, I took my experiences as well with that and thinking, you know, I can play with lots of different materials and it doesn't matter because I don't intend going out to work in industry. I want to do it for me. So it didn't matter if something was absolutely dreadful. It was just a learning experience. Because I think that's how you learn as well. You have to fail and you have to fail again. And it's only when you keep doing things that it actually gets better and better and better. And I look at some of my early stuff and think, oh dear, that's a bit rough.
Well, having a career in the RAF and then working at that charity, that has to have given you really some self-confidence in a foundation that helps you go into, I mean, you went into a complete blank slate here, so you had to have a good foundation, I would think, to be able to lean on yourself to make this happen.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, I joined the Air Force when I was 17, so, you know, pretty much straight out of school. And, you know, going to university wasn't what it is today. You know, there was very few people went out to university, so I'd always wanted to join the Air Force and go into communications. And, you know, I did that for 10 years until I had my children. And, yeah, you get the, you know, you certainly get the opportunity. You have to rely on yourself and you have to, you know, be that confident person. Even if you don't feel it sometimes, you know, you have to portray that. That's, right. You know, the confidence. And you do things that, you know, will, you know, they instill confidence in you because they train you so well. So, you know, I've done completely bonkers things. You know, I have a really, really bad fear of heights. Well, I thought I got a fear of heights, and now realize that it's not a fear of heights, it's a fear of falling. And I thought I'd do a parachute course to see if I could overcome my fear of heights. Well, I after three jumps on my own, I thought, why am I doing this? I don't really need to prove that to anybody. You know, so I went up in the plane the fourth time and went, you know what? No, I'm not doing any more of this. So I went back down with the plane again after everybody else had jumped out.
There we go. Common sense prevails. Yes.
Yeah. Why jump out of a perfectly good airplane? That's, you know, yeah, no.
Yeah. So I don't know whether it's confidence sometimes or just sheer stupidity.
Oh my. So did, as you're going through school, was there a point where you said, hey, I can make a career out of this? Or did you just complete the school and then figure things out?
What, in terms of my embroidery or school, as in? I think it's in the final year, we have to do life briefs with industry. And they were doing a couple of live briefs with some of the big stores and greetings cards firms. And I just, it didn't fit with what I wanted to do. So I chose to do the hand and lock brief, which allowed me to explore my embroidery further. So I spent the whole final year exploring and teaching myself more techniques, and also silk designing fabrics and silk screen printing my own fabrics for a dress, and I made that out of Devore material, so you can actually see all the hand-drawn designs that I placed onto the dress. And then did a lot of laser cutting as well, which is the straps that hold a nicely embellished phoenix onto the back of a dress. And I'd got to the point where I'd come to the end of my final year, and I thought, I've done all the work for the hand and lock, so I might as well submit. So that's what I did. I submitted my proposal and some photographs of where I was so far, because at that point I only had the fabric, I didn't have the dress. Submitted it to Hand and Lock and went off and exhibited at New Designers in London. And a few weeks later, I got the email through from Hand and Lock to say that I was now into the final six. And at that point, it was, right, I'd better finish my submission now. So at that point, I then had to make a dress. I've never made a dress in my life before. I've never even put a zip into a dress, into anything. So it's like, okay, I've drawn a picture of a dress that I want to make, but I don't know how to do it.
Oh my. All right. Well, let's back up on the Phoenix dress then, because that is one amazing piece of art.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Take us through that little journey. I have to make a dress. I've never made one. Oh, great. For hand and lock. Not for my family, but for hand and lock. Yeah, that's good. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing, you see. That's what I meant about sometimes it's, you know, the stupidity rather than confidence. Right? I don't know what I was thinking of, actually, because it was a full on evening dress that I was that I was designing with a lovely train at the back. And I don't know. I suppose at the time I didn't expect to make it through into the final. And I thought, you know, if I ever did, I'd figure that out. Well, I was at the point of having to figure that out. And luckily, by that time, I was also, I'd applied to do my master's at the same university, and my tutor, my supervisor, was going to be one of my tutors from my undergraduate degree. So I emailed her and I went round to her house, and she kindly showed me how to cut a pattern off a dressmaker's dummy. And that's what we did. We cut the pattern all the shapes out at her house. I went home and I started to stitch it all together then. And that's where the dress really was born from. Just, you know, again, a place of being, just learning as I go, you know, no set outcome really. I needed it to look like the drawing, but It didn't matter if it didn't fully. And I just went on and kept adding from there. The laser cut, all the laser cut leather at the front as well, I didn't have that cut either. I had just had all the files set up on Adobe Illustrator, ready to go, but I couldn't find anywhere to get that cut. So for weeks I was trawling through companies and ringing them up and asking if they would do it. They wouldn't do it. In the end, a friend of mine said, why don't you try this not-for-profit place close to the university? And they kindly allowed me to go in and use their laser cutters, so I could get all this laser leather cut. And what I didn't know at the time was how much leather stinks when you put it through a laser cutter.
If
I'd left it any longer, Hand and Lock would have had this very, very smelly dress going into to be exhibited. But I ended up washing it and scrubbing it and trying everything to putting it in with air fresheners into a box, trying to get rid of the smell of this leather. So eventually we went and I was able to stitch into it and embellish it with beads and crystals and stuff, so, and attach it to the dress. So yeah, that's the story of the dress, really. The ideas of it came from I wanted to combine different elements, really. So in there, there's a nod to my military career with all the beautiful gold work that's on there, all of the patterns from on the dress are all drawn from when I visited the Alhambra in southern Spain, and I fell in love with all the beautiful intricate stone carvings on the wall. So I photographed all of that, then went back and I drew my own interpretation of those patterns, which ultimately silkscreen printed onto the dress. But most of all, I think the phoenix, because of the meaning behind it, the rebirth and renewal, that felt like my personal journey. It was something that I felt I'd done. I'd gone through, a tough time with my health. Within my second year of university, they finally found out what was wrong with me. I'd been sent for scans and x-rays and everything else, and they'd found lots of damage in my joints, in my hands and in my feet, which are the only two places they took scans off, so it could be anywhere else, I have no idea. But they diagnosed me with rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia, so it was a nod to that as well. So the whole meaning of the phoenix rising from the ashes and coming out and turning into this beautiful bird, that's what I felt like I was doing. I'd lost a career that I really loved. I couldn't continue doing it, but I'd gone and I suppose reinvented myself again. And this, it was me coming out of the other side as this nicely embellished bird.
Wow.
Well, yeah. And it's beautiful. It's just a gorgeous piece. And all the beading you've done on it, the whole design. And I think you said at one point you like stripped the feathers and then you used.
Yes.
So you used all sorts of materials in it is what would intrigue me.
There is. So I was experimenting again as I was going along. So there's parts of the wings that are on there, which there's layers of beads and sequins together. I'd done one side. I thought, yeah, that looks all right. That does. I did the other side, but I added padding underneath that and raised all the surface on that. And I thought, oh, that looks better. So I unpicked the original side and then raised that up as well. And it was, I just gathered lots and lots of different materials and started placing them next to each other. And that's how I tend to work, really. I don't particularly plan out areas of things. I get lots of material together and start to place them side by side, moving them around all the time and seeing what actually fits, and then playing around with different techniques and overlaying and weaving bits in between and seeing what. And I do lots of little samples as well to see if it's going to work in practice of what is in my head. So in terms of the feathers as well, I got a lot of goose bites feathers, and I thought, how, they're just a bit flat. How can I get them to do what I needed them to do? So I started running things up against the back of the feathers, and I found that they started to twirl with them. So then that's what I thought, that looks like an eyelash. So that's what I, on the head of the phoenix, there's a lovely grey feather there, which is beautifully shaped, which was literally done with just running a ruler down the back of the feather. And it's just sometimes simple, little simple techniques that make all the difference.
Yeah, that, it's just an amazing piece. Just amazing. Yeah. Bravo.
Yeah.
Bravo.
All right. So where does the coral reef part come in? Because that series that you did with shells and your interpretation of coral is just absolutely stunning. And it has more meaning to me because I have many years of keeping reef aquariums and raising coral. So when I saw those, I really connected with you. Where does that come from?
So I've always been drawn to the ocean. It's just, I find that my, you know, a comfort place. I can sit there and I can listen to the sound of the sea coming in, and it's just, I love it. I'm at home there. And a few years ago, I've never really been out into the sea. I've done a lot of fishing offshore and done shark fishing and tuna fishing and stuff. And, you know, I was always a bit scared about what's in the ocean because of pulling these big things with big teeth out. And so I'd learned to snorkel when we're across in Europe. And we managed to get on holiday, and I went to Jamaica, and I thought, you know what, I want to see what's, I want to see what's underneath the ocean. So I learned how to scuba dive, and I took my open water diver qualification instead of being sat on the beach on holiday. So I was sat on the beach with my books open, you know, learning all the things that I had to do, and I was in the swimming pool and, you know, learning how to dive. And I went out and I saw the coral reef, and it was something that I've been researching anyway within my master's, but this also gave, you know, I was able to see firsthand the coral reef, and it wasn't what I expected. You know, I expected lots and lots of colourful reefs, you know, that you see in the pictures from people diving on the Great Barrier Reef, but I saw lots of devastation as well. So it was grey, and big parts of it, there was just, it was dead. And that, you know, that was devastating. I just didn't expect to see it. You know, I didn't want to see that, but there it is. You know, there's lots of, you know, pollution and littering and weather events, that's, you know, and the global warming, you know, it's all had a massive impact on what, you know, the coral reef is doing at the moment. And, you know, I felt I had to do something about that, you know, in my own, you know, my own little way. So that really spurred me on to celebrate what you know, the coral reef, how I interpret it should really look like. And I've done pieces as well where it shows the two sides to it as well. I did a lovely piece of wood that I'd found walking along the beach, and it had been burnt by people having fires on the beach, but then it was also been smoothed from the sea on the rocks and everything. And that was something that I felt I could use. So I did two pieces of embroidery, one in completely white and greys, and then the other, the contrasting side of really beautiful, bright, bold 3D corals. So that's where that was born, really. Just the love of the ocean and, you know, how I wanted to see the coral reef. So, and it's something that I've really pushed as well with that, because I've got pieces where I've used recycled plastic containers, where I've rummaged in people's recycling bins and, you know, cut the tops off bottles and containers, and then done my embroidery and then encased that in resin as well, just to combine the two, really, of, you know, this is plastic waste, and this, you know, potentially of what the damage it's doing to our corals.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because the Caribbean is one of the great tragedies of coral reefs. I mean, there was a time when coral was so thick they had to literally cut through it to make channels so boats could get through. It was so thick, and it's just been destroyed by a lot of factors, some natural and most of them man-made. And to call attention to that is so important, because, I mean, there's several organizations that are working to restore reefs in the Caribbean, but it's a real uphill struggle. And, the pollution, all of it. So calling attention to that is really admirable, because coral reefs are beautiful, and people don't, if you haven't seen them, or in my case, grown them in aquariums, you really don't appreciate the colors and the textures and the beauty, and you really bring that out in your artwork. It's really, really very moving.
Thank you. And it's something as well, you know, that I try to, to show that, really, but also to use, materials which are having that devastating effect, but also other materials. So through research, I looked at what the work that marine biologists were doing, and they found that some of the concrete is really helpful to growing in corals. So it's something to do with the calcium or something, you know, like that. But it's, they use it as a substrate to then be able to build, to grow new corals on this concrete. So some of the works that I've done that uses concrete is to give a nod to the amazing work that people are doing, you know, to help, you know, to grow new corals, really.
Yeah, no, that's that concrete is one thing. There have been organizations that, yeah, they sink concrete and make the bases for reefs, because that's the part. If you go to the Great Barrier Reef, I mean, there's just eons of time that have built those things up, and the coral need a place to land somewhere, so they have to. When you put down concrete like that, or some people have tried tires and that doesn't work, but all kinds of things. So yeah, recognizing those efforts is also admirable. Yeah, it's great. So have you, do you continue to scuba dive, or did that become the one shot and you haven't gone back?
No, I haven't had the opportunity to go back, really. You know, it's something that I think I will do again, because it was just fantastic, you know, despite me not seeing what I wanted to see, the experience was just amazing anyway. Right. So yeah, it's, you know, I've not had the chance to do it so far, but yeah, it's on the to-do list again.
So what is your next project? Do you have a new series that you're working on, or what's coming up for you?
I don't know yet. I've been finishing off my corals because I love doing the corals anyway. So I think that's going to be a continuous theme anyway of what I do. I'm working on insects at the moment. So I'm going to be looking at doing some 3D insects, I think. And then I'm just in the playing around mode at the moment and just testing out what I can do with them. But yeah, I just want to build more experimental things, I suppose. You know, I'm in that playtime.
Yeah.
So do you spend a lot of time then playing with your materials before you jump off and actually say, okay, now I'm going to create this with what I've just played with?
Yeah. I collect materials as well wherever we go. So in the garage of the motorhome, I've got about 6 or 7 pieces of wood that I found whilst I was beachcombing. So, and I've got lots of sea glass as well. So I keep all those things and I just set them aside so that it's to give it a chance to speak to me, because I see something there and think, yes, that would work, but I don't know what it's going to work with at the time. So I sit there and look at it. It can be for months and months. It'll be sat there until it starts to talk to me and go, you can do this with it. So I don't know whether I'm going to use them and use them as a base for some insects at the moment. I'm not sure. But yeah, I'm playing around with techniques and stuff and different materials at the moment. So, you know, I'd like to have more time to do my embroidery, but I have to remember that that is, you know, secondary. I've got my caring role first, and then so I fit in between that and collecting materials and playing around. You know, I'd love to have more time.
So do you mainly work just on one piece at a time then, or do you keep several projects kind of in various stages?
No, I have loads of projects on the go at the same time.
Yay.
I have about 5 frames in the bag, all at differing stages of completedness. And I'll go between them all, really. I'd had quite a few of my coral projects on the go at the same time, and I'd stopped creating for quite a while, and they were just sat there. So over the past few months, I've been slowly getting there and finishing all of those, you know, that there. So I've only got 1 frame on the go at the moment, which is amazing for me, because that never happens. So
that never happens. That never happens at my house. Never, never.
No, I said I have to finish these things before I start on a completely new project. And but then I've been sat there over the last week or so thinking, oh, I've got a thing there. I fancy doing some more little corals.
How does the?
And I suppose that.
Yeah, go ahead. How does the needlework and arthritis come together? Is it does it help to be stitching and keeping your joints moving, or does it limit you?
Sometimes it limits me. I have to listen to my body.
Yeah.
You know, I can't get away from, you know, that's what it is. However, I think, you know, everything else that we've done with change the lifestyle and everything else, it's not just helped my partner, it's helped me as well. Because my last appointment with a rheumatologist said, he's discharged me, I'm in remission, I'm not medicating or anything else. So whatever I've been doing over the past few years, and keeping, you know, keeping moving as well, especially my hands, I think has really, really helped. And don't get me wrong, there's been these days where, you know, I really don't want to do something, but I know, I have to tell myself, moving and keeping going and everything else is really helpful. You know, otherwise my joints do seize up, especially my hands. And, you know, I have what I call fat finger days where I couldn't even pick up a needle because I just drop everything. So I do something else on that day. And yeah, it's whatever it's helpful. It's been helpful. But if I sit and then, because I can get completely lost as well in my embroidery, and I could, if I wasn't careful, sit there for hours and then my back starts playing up and then I can't move. So right. I have to make sure that I'm getting up and I'm moving around and I go out for a walk and, you know, those sorts of things. You know, it's a really fine balance.
Yeah. But it sounds like the mental health aspect is almost more important.
Definitely. I think the issue that I've found as well, because I am a carer for somebody with, you know, severe mental health issues, you know, often people forget about, you know, the carer as well. And my embroidery really helps to keep my head clear and to keep me going every single day. You know, that's definitely my go-to when we're having, you know, a really tough time. I'll disappear and I'll just sit quietly and I'll just sew for a little bit. And, you know, that helps my mental health because I could get quite easily sucked into the day-to-day difficulties of, you know, the reality of our life, really. You know, it's not, I'm not going to sugarcoat it because it's not easy. You know, every day is different as well. And it's, you know, we can't predict anything, you know, with, you know, what that day is going to be like, how he's going to be feeling and stuff. So, you know, I have to as well juggle that and think, there's no possible way that I can do any embroidery at the moment because I've got other priorities and commitments. But then I think actually I have to do a little bit of something to protect me and to help my mental health. So yeah, it's certainly helpful. I think, you know, any creative outlet really is good for us. You know, and it's certainly good for me, that's for sure.
Yeah, that power of needlework, boy, we hear it time and time again, how it just helps people at all levels to just find a calm place and a quiet little moment. Yeah, it's incredible. It really is.
It is the mindfulness, you know, around it as well. And you could just, and it doesn't matter sometimes what you're creating. You know, you could be just literally doing running stitches across a piece of fabric and just to lose yourself in the monotony of that, or take it outside and just get away from the normal run of the mill, you know, day to day things, and just take, you know, whether it's your drawing or doing something, and it doesn't have to be for anybody else, but just for yourself.
Right. Right. And it's calming, you know, just there's something about that motion of pulling a needle and thread through a piece of fabric. That is, I find very calming, that if I'm very stressed, just to do that just for a few minutes seems to kind of get rid of a lot of the tension of the day.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's very cool. Yep. All right, Claire, thank you so much for giving us a little look into an amazing lifestyle and equally amazing needlework. Wow. I got to go get a mobile home, I'm telling you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. Thanks so much for sharing with us, and thanks to everyone for listening.